9 of the Reporter's Corner. I'm one half your co-host, Jared Urbato with the Bemidji Pioneer. With me is the other half, co-host Trent Singer with Sioux Falls Live. Trent, how are we doing today?
Doing great. Doing great, Jared. How are you doing?
Good. Good. We got a good one for you today. We brought on head coach of Ferris State, Bob Daniels, who just got his 500 winning against Lake Superior State this past weekend. This is running a week after he got the win. But yeah, awesome chat with Bob Daniels. Trent, you have a little bit of history with him. You did a whole big story on him. And before we get into anything else, go read Trent's story from this summer on the Rink Live about Bob Daniels, because it was an awesome, awesome read and a deep dive into one of the more legendary college hockey coaches ever. And it'll be a good primer for what we talked about today. So, Trent, talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, if you are a fan of college hockey, Bob Daniels is pretty quintessential to the sport, I think. You're just going to hear so many names in this podcast and in this episode of some familiar names that you've heard before, guys like Jeff Jackson, Don Lucia, Ron Mason, Red Berenson. And then you're going to hear about a lot of Ferris State players, obviously, because the history of this program is entrenched in Bob Daniels' career. He's a 32nd year as a coach. He just recently became the 17th coach to reach 500 Division I wins. But yeah, we talked about everything, man. We talked a little bit about the early days and growing up in Livonia, Michigan, which is just a suburb of Detroit. And we talked a little bit about, just the coaching career and how it started. He walked on at Michigan State as a player, played one game total at the varsity level. He was a junior varsity player at Michigan State back when they had that. And then he eventually became the head coach at Ferris State in the early 90s and the head coach in 92 and his title he's held all the way up until today. So just a great, great talk. He's always a great person to interview, and he's just full of stories. He's full of just so much history. I mean, that's one thing we're really going to lose when Bob Daniels decides to hang it up. I'm sure those days are numbered at this point. I mean, when you've been doing it for 32 years and he's 65 years old now, I think it's that time is coming. And we talked a lot about his assistant coaches as well. His assistant coaches have been with him. One of them's been with him since the start, and Drew Famulak, and then guys like Dave Sensor and Mark Kaufman have been with him for almost two decades and counting. So yeah, just a great chat with Coach Daniels. And I really think if you're a college hockey fan in general, you'll enjoy this one. And especially if you're a Ferris State fan, you're just this is the guy. So I hope you guys like it.
And he is no short on stories. He's got,
oh no.
And he had a really, really good one to end the show. So you got to listen through, because that was one of the funnier ones we've had on the show so far. So yeah, we'll kick into our interview with Bob Daniels. And once again, thank you to Coach Daniels for coming on the show, and congratulations on getting win number 500.
Well, welcome into another episode of the Reporter's Corner. And we've got one of my favorite people in the CCHA here, and Coach Daniels, who just got his 500th win. And no better time to talk to Coach Daniels. Coach, how's everything going? You said it's a rough day out there in Big Rapids right now, but how's everything going with the team and what's going on?
Well, Trent, you know what? It's going remarkably well, given our record. The team, it's an interesting team in that I'm very optimistic about the future, the remainder of the season. I think for the most part, we've played really, really well at times, maybe not as consistent as we'd like. But from what I've seen so far, we're in a lot of games. As I said, I'm optimistic about this group moving forward. It's a great group of guys who work really hard. They're a real close-knit group. And they seem to have some resiliency to them. You add all that up, and I'm excited about the potential for this year.
Yeah, we as we're recording this, we're coming off a series split for Ferris State against Lake State this weekend, and then they will play Augustana this upcoming weekend. But over the weekend, the big news out of Ferris State, Coach Daniels, you become the 17th coach to reach 500 wins at the Division I level. What does that accomplishment mean to you?
Wow, I haven't really had a ton of time to reflect on it. You know, I do think it's a good opportunity though to reflect back on the years and all the people that have touched the program and all the great coaches I've worked with and coached against. But you know, the ones that have been here, obviously our staff currently has been together for a long time. I've been with Drew Famulak for 32 years. That's longer than a lot of marriages, guys. You know? And there's days when it seems like it's a marriage, you know, we can bicker with the best of them. But Mark Kaufman has been with us at two separate occasions, and that's right around 20-some years, and same with Dave Sensor. But other coaches, Jeff Blashill and Derek Lalonde, Seth Appert, Jamie Russell, just some really great coaches that have come through here that I've had the opportunity to work with, that have gone on and really excelled once they've left here. And then, you know, the different people within the institution you work with are, you know, you think about how fortunate I've been. I think it's been five ADs, and all five were great to work with. I mean, really good, really supported hockey. And the same thing with the presidents of our university, including the current AD and president here, are very supportive of not just hockey, but athletics. And I don't think without those kind of people around, you could last 33 years in a position. You know, it's a tough job. There's a lot of stressors, if you will. And to have the support of the administration has been very beneficial. So, you know, and then obviously you think about all the great players that you've had, you know, really the pleasure to coach. And, you know, whether it's Chris Kunitz, Gerald Mayhew, Zach Redmond, there's too many, obviously, to name, but there's been a lot of really good players that I've had the good fortune to work with. And so, you know, I think when you hit a milestone, because that's all it is just a nice round number. It's, you know, what is 500? I don't know. But it does give you, you know, you sit back and say, wow, you know, a blink of an eye, it's gone pretty quick.
To follow up on that just a little bit too, I mean, you know, you say it's just a number. Was there any notable celebration after you got that 500th win?
No, but it was kind of interesting. I've got a close friend. It's actually Jeff Blashill's brother-in-law, lives up in Traverse City. And after the game, my wife and I went out for dinner, and I'll be darned, I ran into him. And so it ended up becoming like an impromptu celebration, and we had some fun. And it couldn't have been a more perfect night. But, you know, it's the middle of the year. You wake up on Sunday morning, you're like, okay, how are we going to handle Augustana now? You know, that's a good hockey team. So how are we going to be able to handle them? And you immediately just kind of turn the page, and, you know, you're so absorbed into this season and this year's team. And that's, so sometimes some of these milestone type wins, you don't really reflect and think about until the year's over.
When you think about, you know, the previous milestones, obviously you had to get to 100 and 200 and 300 and 400 before you get to 500. You know, when the time comes to reflect on those milestones, what's that feeling like of just, you know, does it kind of go back to like what you said of like, man, like it goes by in a blink of an eye to get to those milestones?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, for me, it'll be kind of a good time. Like I say, it gives you an opportunity to really put in perspective all the great people that you've come into contact. And I mentioned some of the other coaches. When I started off at Ferris, we were in the CCHA with, you know, Michigan State, Michigan, Ohio State. And I'm just thinking of some of the coaches I've had the pleasure to see work, you know, and compete against. And, you know, you're talking about Ron Mason and Red Berenson and Jerry York, all in the same league. That, you know, talk about a tough way to try to, you know, be a young coach. But they were great gentlemen and very helpful. You know, I found them to be very giving, and they really, to me, they showed you how to run a program and how to run it correctly. And Don Lucia, Don was at UAF back in the day, and then CC, and then finally Minnesota. Jeff Jackson comes to mind. Him and I started butting heads coaching junior hockey in what is now the North American League. So, you know, you think back of all the different people that being in hockey has allowed you to get to know, and how fortunate you are to be in a sport where it is a pretty tight-knit group of people.
You just said a bunch of the names that have hit this 500 milestone, right? You know, obviously Lucia, Mason, Pecknold, Schaefer, Jeff Jackson, Berenson, Frank Ceratori. You know, those are all the active coaches that have hit 500. You know, to have your name be on that same level as them, you know, guys who have been in this game for decades, legends coaching this game. You know, what do you take away from that? What does that honor mean to you?
Wow, it's pretty humbling. I never actually stopped and thought about it just the way you put that. Yeah, it's humbling, and you wonder, hey, do I belong in this group? I you know, I hope I've conducted myself in a way that maybe, you know, 20 years from now, some young coach that I coached against, you know, would say, wow, I learned a lot from him and how to conduct yourself. And, you know, like I say, I was taught well in terms of behaving, acting like a gentleman, competing as hard as you can, you know, but still having some fellowship with your the opposing coaches. And I hope that trend continues, because it is a tight-knit sport, and it's a sport where I think a lot of people care about one another. Certainly you want to win. The night you're playing it against somebody, you want to beat them. But I think it might be the whole thing too, that each year we go to Naples for the coaches convention, and you know, we run into each other at rinks, scouting, and so it is a small world, and you get to know the different coaches and their families. And I just, you know, in this day and age too, things are getting a little dicier with transfer portals and all the different things, the changes that have come. But I'd hate to see the camaraderie that we have and really the ability to reach out and help out another coach if they're going through a tough time, or have them reach out to you and give you a hand if you're going through a rough patch. And, you know, I just feel over the years, like a Coach Hastings, when he took over the Mavericks at Minnesota State, you know, him and I developed we had a relationship where we were recruiting players off his junior teams. But, you know, we quickly developed a relationship in college hockey. And I just hope that perpetuates, you know, as these changes continue to hit college hockey.
Coach, you know, we talked this summer, and did a story, a retrospective a lot on your career, and I'm still curious. You know, I want to go through a lot of the stuff I talked about and we went over, just because I love to hear it come out of your mouth. I mean, it's always fascinating to hear you talk about your early exposure to hockey. You grew up in Livonia, which is a suburb of Detroit, and your father Pete was a penalty timekeeper at the Old Red Barn, which is, you know, more formally known as Olympia Stadium. What do you remember about those early years and how hockey just kind of left an impression on your life?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I was young and growing up, hockey was it was still hot in Detroit. It was big, but it was almost a cult type thing, you know, where everyone played football and basketball and baseball. And I certainly played those sports, but you were looked at as a bit of an oddity, like in grade school and high school. Oh, you play hockey, you know. I don't know anything about the number of people. I don't know anything about it. You guys fight a lot. All they knew about it. And then there was, you know, it was interesting. When I was probably around 12, there was an explosion of indoor arenas built. When I first started playing, there may have been three indoor arenas in the whole Metro Detroit area. We used to cross the border into Canada because, you know, obviously we're a border city. And we would practice there once a week just to get ice time. But then all of a sudden, I don't know, it was the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, and there was an explosion. Within 2 years, there was two indoor arenas built within the city I lived in, Livonia. So all of a sudden, these arenas just sprouted out throughout Metro Detroit, and hockey really blew up. But, you know, I just remember the accessibility of the NHL players when my dad worked there. And it wasn't just me, but you could go watch a practice, you know, right after school, you know, say 3 o'clock, go to Olympia, and there might be 100 kids there, and you could just talk to the players. I mean, they were so accessible. And I think it's that culture within hockey that has helped it to grow and foster. And, you know, pretty much wherever an NHL team sprouts up, I think the availability of those players to the fans is one of the reasons that the sport sells. And I think the modesty of a lot of the hockey players, it comes off as genuine, and it is. And I think that it makes it endearing to the fans. And so of anything, I think just the growth and evolution of the sport.
You walked on at Michigan State, and that's where you kind of got to know Ron Mason and the late Sean Walsh. And, you know, what can you tell us about your collegiate career, albeit it was brief?
It was very brief. But it was a long brief. Let's put it that way. It was yep. 3 years of playing. I only had 3 years of eligibility because when I was playing junior hockey, I went to community college for 2 years.
Gotcha.
So I kept my, you know, education was always important to my father and our family. And he, that was way ahead of hockey. Education was where it was at for him. So, you know, he said, you can do what you want with hockey, but you're going to continue going to school. So when I got to state, I had 3 years of eligibility, played in one game, practiced a lot. but what a great breeding ground. So my first year there was Ron Mason's first year. The, believe it or not, the guy that recruited me to go there as a walk-on was a gentleman by the name of Amo Pisoni. So you talk about another legendary name within college hockey. So Amo recruited me, but then lo and behold, retired, and Ron came in that summer. And I remember, you know, I didn't have the pleasure to play for Coach Pisoni, but I remember Ron addressing the team early on his first year, and I'm like, man, this guy's got it. Like, his clarity of thought, his ability to communicate, expectations. I said, this guy's got it. And then, you know, Sean Walsh was like a first year assistant for him. He'd been like a GA at Bowling Green for Ron. And I thought to myself, this guy's not lacking confidence. He was a very confident individual. And I liked him. And what a great laboratory. So I even knew at that time that, you know, playing hockey was going to be short lived. There was no future after college for me. But I would like to coach, and I'd like to coach collegiately if I could. So I was, you know, able to really watch how they built that program at Michigan State, and I learned a lot. And I don't think I could have been in a better situation to be in the career that I am now, you know, having observed Ron Mason and Sean Walsh and George Gwozdecki. So those are three pretty big names to watch and emulate.
No doubt. I mean, talk about like the perfect people to kind of get your coaching career started. You started in the NAHL with the Hennessy Engineers, and eventually you made your way to Miami and Illinois, Chicago. I know as a grad assistant at Miami, and then I think it was 3 years, I think, in Illinois, Chicago, if I'm correct. What can you just tell us about your coaching experience prior to making your way to Ferris State?
Well, yeah, the interesting thing in the NAHL, it was at that time it was called the Great Lakes Junior Hockey League. And actually, it was on par with the USHL. I played in that league. And when I was playing juniors, the winner of that league, the Great Lakes League, would play the winner of the USHL for the national title. And so that was a great, great place to start coaching. As I mentioned, one of the other coaches of one of the other teams was Jeff Jackson. And we met in the league finals a couple of times. And, you know, so that you really learn how to coach when you're coaching juniors, because you're also trying to figure out a way to pay ice bills and right. all the different things that go on in junior hockey. You get a lot of scars coaching junior hockey. You really do. And then, you know, I was really fortunate. Mark Kaufman, one of our other coaches here, was at Miami of Ohio at the time and said, hey, Bob, this is a great situation. You can get a graduate assistantship. They'll pay for your master's degree. And you really act as a second assistant on the team, because you only had the budget for one assistant at that time. And so I was fortunate to meet Bill Davich, who was the head coach there, and catch on. I was supposed to be there 2 years, but after the first year, there was an opening at Illinois Chicago, and I was fortunate enough to get the job. I did go back in the summers and get my master's degree, though, from Miami. And then I worked with Val Balmani at UIC and learned a ton there. But I always wanted to be in a college town. And while I liked Chicago a lot, I was always drawn to a college town. And when the opening came here at Ferris, I said, that's a perfect size college town for me. You know, it's a town of about 15,000 people, a school of about 12,000. Definitely a college town. It's got a great vibrance about it because of that. Wonderful people. And I just said, hey, this, you know, this is a place for me. And I, John Perpich, who had played for Herb Brooks at Minnesota and then came, went on to be head coach here at Ferris, hired me on, and I worked here for him. He was here 1 year and then left for the NHL. And then Bob Mancini, who later on became coach at Michigan Tech. And when, you know, I coached 2 years under Bob here, learned a ton from Bob. And then Bob went to Tech, and I took over. I was fortunate enough to get the job at a pretty young age here at Ferris.
You were 32 when you took over as the interim coach at Ferris, which, you know, at in any era of hockey, that's a young age to, you know, be a head coach. What do you remember from just how eye-opening that experience was for you right away?
Well, what I, one of the things I remember really fondly of my first, you know, three, four years here were the players that were here. What a group, what a collection. There's still some of our best alums. You know, the first year we did make it to Joe Louis. We got to the Final Four in the CCHA. But it was a really interesting group of kids. They were hard-nosed, tough. They had their share of fun away from the rink, too. They were just a lively group. And thank God I was young, because I don't know at my age if I could handle that group again. But, you know, Johnny Gruden, who ended up playing 600-plus games in NHL, was on that team. A guy by the name of Dwight Parrish was our captain. And it was a, you know, Jeff Blashill was a goaltender, and Seth Appert. Seth's now with Buffalo as an assistant coach for Lindy Ruff. And Jeff was coach of the Red Wings and is now assistant with John Cooper in Tampa. So those guys were on the team, though, and they were a good group. Like I said, they were lively and spirited. But we needed to be, like, we were trying to make our mark on college hockey and prove we belonged. And you, we needed a kind of that attitude. And it was a chip on their shoulder type attitude. And as I say, I was young then, and I was able to kind of corral that group, if you will.
I want to talk a little bit about the CCHA during that time. I mean, it was a tough conference to play in during the 90s and the early 2000s. I mean, what can you sort of tell us about how hard it was to compete night in and night out just back then?
Oh, that was really a tough conference. And you think, like, as I mentioned, Jerry York and Bowling Green, and they had won national titles. They, you know, they had the connection in Ontario recruiting, and they were formidable. They, some of the best teams I coached against were those, you know, the earlier Bowling Green teams. And then obviously Michigan, you know, they had their run in the late 90s of unbelievable players, you know, Madden, McCault, Leg. I mean, they just would roll out the talent. And then obviously Frank Anzalone and then Jeff Jackson at Lake Superior State, they were, you know, winning national titles. Ron Mason at Michigan State. So this was a tough league. You know, you would know in the conference before the year started that you're going to have at least four teams in the top 10 of the country in your conference. And, you know, we are the beneficiaries. A lot of kids, I mean, kids wanted to play in that conference as well. So we were able to draw our share of talent to Ferris State. But you had to really be on your game. I mean, those were good coaches. Those were great programs. And you had to be on your game to compete with them. I can reflect on a story, too. I remember Red Berenson had come out of NHL, and he had obviously was a great Hall of Fame player. Actually, he was my idol growing up. You know, he played for the Wings for his career, and I loved him. But he tells a story of how when he first started in college hockey, they played Michigan State one night on a Saturday. And on a Sunday, he was like in a rink in Ontario, and all, maybe it was London, Ontario. I don't remember the exact city. And, you know, he had to be up at like 5, 6 in the morning on that Sunday to get to the game because it was an early morning game. And he's thinking to himself, well, I'm getting a jump on a lot of people. And he looked across the rink, and there sits Ron Mason. You know, he's like, oh, my God, I guess I'm not getting a jump. This is just keeping me even. But that's what you learned early on is you better hit the ground running.
obviously, you know, one of the big seasons in Ferris State history was 02-03, and that was the season led by Chris Kunitz, was a Hobey Baker finalist. I think you guys went 31-10-1. Just what do you remember most about that season?
Wow, you know, obviously Chris was just a terrific player, and there's a lot of different things I remember. I do know we had a really good supporting cast too, Jeff Legui, and you know, our captain was player by the name of Troy Milam, and Troy played forever in Europe. It was a great captain. He had captained a CompuWare junior team to a national title. So it was another team that was kind of rough and tumble too. If I remember correctly, we lapped the field in penalty minutes that year. It was a tough, hard-nosed team. But it was a team that if you're going to go into uncharted waters as a program and win a conference with the likes of Michigan, Michigan State, and you know Notre Dame's and Lake State's, you needed to have a rough and tumble group. I mean, they had to believe in themselves and they had to be hard-nosed, and that team was. I remember we played North Dakota in the regional for our first NCAA game. We beat them 5-2, and you know, I knew those teams were physical, but we had our way with them physically. And then that night, or the next day, we played Minnesota, and the tournament was. The regional sites back then were on campus, and this was held at Mariucci. And I always felt like this team could have been a national title team if we didn't have to face Minnesota at Minnesota the second game. You know, maybe we, because they had the Olympic sheet too. Mm-hmm. Had we seen them on an NHL sheet in a neutral site, I think we would have had a chance. They had a great team, don't get me wrong. But we were a team that we'd spent a lot of the season you know, in the top three, in number one in the country. So, you know, I always feel bad for that team, and that I think we could have gone even further if we didn't have to run into a team as strong as Minnesota on their home ice.
Yeah, I want to single out another season. I mean, that 2011-12 season was another big one for you. Yeah, it was certainly a magical one in Big Rapids, too. I mean, just, yeah, that team had guys like Chad Billings and Tommy Hill and Taylor Nelson and net. What was that journey just like to be a part of? Because that was even more of like a kind of an unexpected run in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it was that, you know, all those players you had mentioned, you know, Chad Billings, he spent, you know, I don't know how many games he played in the National Hockey League, but he spent time in the National Hockey League and continued up to like a year or two ago playing in Europe at the highest levels. It was a really good team, highly talented, maybe not a superstar in the group, but a good team with a capital T.
Yeah.
Very together. We had four lines deep. That year, it was interesting. I had two defensemen. Tommy Hill was one of them that were both, you know, 6'5" or so. That actually ended up second half of the year moved them to forward because we were that deep on defense and they played great for us up front. And so it was a selfless team in that they had no problem moving. They were both seniors and they had no problem whatsoever moving, changing positions late in their career to help the team. And I think it was that selflessness. Tommy Hill was one of our captains that year. It was his, you know, leading by example and wherever I can help coach is where I'll play. But yeah, that obviously was one of the best teams we've ever had here. But of all the teams, that was, you know, probably the closest group of guys and certainly, you know, the deepest, you know, from top to bottom. We had, as I say, we rolled four lines the entire year.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of those kids are right. They went on to become coaches, and you have a pretty extensive coaching tree now, and you add the names like Trevor Large and Derek Lalonde, right? I mean, it's, you know, there's plenty of guys that you've coached that have now gone on to become coaches themselves. So how rewarding is that to see them enter those ranks?
That's really, yeah. I'm excited to have number one, had the ability to work with them as players and as coaches. And there's a lot of, you mentioned Taylor Nelson, you know, he's with Augustana now, and Tommy Hill's at St. Lawrence, and there's another player we had, it was captain, Cody Chupp, who's now at Minnesota Duluth. And I think you're going to see, like, where Trevor Large is now established as head coach at Canisius, I think you're going to see the Cody Chubbs and Taylor Nelsons and Tommy Hills emerge as Division I head coaches. I think they have that kind of talent. They're going to be outstanding wherever they're at. And I think each one of those guys will be ready in the near future to be a Division I coach. So I love it because if, you know, this is the great thing is I'm able to pick up the phone and I could call anyone and say, okay, our defensive zone right now sucks. What do you got for me? How can you help me? And these guys are really generous. You know, they'll send some video my way and, you know, it's great. It's great to be able to pick up the phone and bounce things off of other people and say, okay, here, I'm going to send you a game. Just take a quick peek at this and tell me, you know, like, we're too close to it. What we're missing something here. And what can you what can you do to help us?
Right.
Go ahead, Trent.
Oh yeah, no, I want to ask about your assistant coaches too. You've touched on it a little bit, and I just think it's truly incredible how you've been able to maintain these assistants for all these years. You know, guys like Drew Famulak, been here since the start, right? Dave Sensor's been here for more than 20 years. Mark Kaufman about 18 years. What has it just meant to you to have those guys by your side this just all this time?
Well, first and foremost, they're all very close friends of mine. Wasn't that way necessarily to start, although Mark Kaufman and I were roommates at Michigan State. So,
right.
You know, we go back a long way. But Mark, you know, his journey has led him to the National Hockey League. He was assistant with the San Jose Sharks and coached in the American League as a head coach, coached in the USHL, East Coast League. Wealth of experience. And as I said, we're very close. So that's easy for us to work together. Same with Drew Famulak. He's been up with us, you know, him and I together for 32 years. So, you know, we can kind of complete each other's sentences. And Dave Sensor is very talented individual himself. He started out really he was a goaltender. He played high school hockey here in Big Rapids. Started out when he got his degree, he started out as a night editor of the paper and volunteered during the day with our team and eventually became our strength and conditioning coach, video coach. And then when we went to three coaches, he, you know, we elevated him to one of the assistants, but partway through his journey with us, he took time off to go work with the Chicago Blackhawks the year they won their first cup, you know, recent cup. And I believe that was 07. And he was their strength and conditioning video coach between Rockford and Chicago. So, obviously, these guys were all highly qualified. But I think for us, the most important thing is we all get along so well together. We've watched each other's children grow up. Dave Sensor's younger than us, so we're getting a chance to watch his kids grow up now. Glad that they're his kids. They're wonderful, but I don't think I could go back and, you know, have three children under the age of seven. At my age, I don't know. I have that kind of energy level.
Right.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the alumni golf outing too, because it's something that obviously Coach Famulak puts on every year, and it gets such a massive turnout from what I've heard. And what can you tell us about that kind of spectacle and what it's evolved to and the stuff it entails?
It's fantastic. It's one of my favorite days of the year. And you know, we've got alums coming back from the very origins of the program. There's a collection of about five or six that would have started out playing in the, you know, late 70s together, and they continue to come back. And I think maybe each one of them has missed one, you know, due to a wedding or something. But these guys have been coming back for almost 50 years, and it's just great to see them every year and catch up. And then, obviously, you've got the group that played for us, and I love catching up with them. You know, many of them have children now that are in college or are through college, and then many of them are just, you know, first time fathers. And it's just great to catch up, see how their careers, you know, if they're not in hockey, how their career is going outside of hockey, whether they're accounting, finance, whatever their profession may be, and find out, you know, how their journey with their children is going. And it's a really good event. A lot of beer flows. If you know, if it's a hockey golf outing, alumni yeah. going to be. But you know what? Everyone has just a terrific time, and you know we get a great attendance. We run it at first Saturday in August every year, and it's just something I think that the guys just mark off on their calendars. And I hope we don't lose that moving forward. And when I say that, you know, with the transfer portal now, you know, player, I think you develop that type of loyalty over like a 4-year period. And you just hope that we're able to keep that sense of family going here at Ferris into the future. And you know, I think things will settle down eventually with the portal. I don't think you'll see quite the numbers that we see now. And maybe some guardrails will be put on it legislatively, you know, where maybe it's a one-time transfer and not multiple. But I would, you know, I don't begrudge the kids the ability to find a place that they're comfortable and they want to be. You know, I think maybe the rules were too punitive before, but there's got to be a middle ground where, you know, you can learn that things aren't always going to be so smooth for you, that you know, the coach and the player got to work through it together. And that when you come out the other side, that you bond in a pretty good relationship.
You know, in your story over the summer too, you said something I thought was really, really interesting. And I don't know if it's interesting so much. I think it was more so interesting because a lot of times you would expect an older coach to talk and rail against, well, I'm sick of today's era of college hockey and it's not like it used to be, but you really weren't that way at all. When I talked with you, you mentioned how today's era of recruiting keeps you young in a sense.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know how important has it been for coaches to adapt and sort of rewire how they approach that recruiting process?
I would say, you know, it to me, it kind of revitalized me in some respects. You know, obviously knee-jerk reaction is this is awful. You know,
right.
It's terrible. I hate it. And then once you get to the point where you realize, you know what, it's not going away. This is the new normal. Okay, how do we utilize this to help ourselves? And what you find is that you've got to communicate with your current players, and you can't change the way you coach. I don't think it'd be successful. I think you've still got to be, strict. You've got to be focused on the end result and the goal, and that requires, you know, if you've got to set a player, you got to set a player. But that's part of their development too. That I think that's an important part of their development. But along the way, maybe be a little more communicative than you were in the past, where you just sat them and, you know, maybe talk to them on Wednesday. But now I think you need to be a little more communicative. You know, it's interesting the players you get out of the portal this year. This is by far the most we've had. We've gotten 5 players out of the portal. Luckily, unfortunately, all 5 have played and played pretty prominent roles. But you give them a second lease on life, and you find that they come in here and they're appreciative of the opportunities.
Right.
With a lot of these kids, they weren't really playing a lot where they were, and the need for us was there. And so they've been able to come in and get a new lease on life, so to speak. And so that's refreshing, and to see how they appreciate the opportunity.
It's kind of a loaded question for you, Coach, because you got over 3 decades of experience packed into this question, but just what makes Ferris State such a special place to you?
Well, first and foremost, like the community of Big Rapids is wonderful. I think I alluded, there's about 15,000 people. All 3 of my kids went through the public school system here. It's a great public school system. Being in a university town, education is important to a lot of people. So everyone kind of keeps an eye, makes, you know, so they get a quality education. And it's small enough where, you know, you kind of know what your own children are up to. And I'm glad they had a chance to go to a high school that, you know, 600 students. It's not overly big. If you wanted to be whatever that you wanted to be involved with, you could be involved with. And one thing I just remember, it hit me right away when we, you know, I was watching my one daughter in the marching band here. And at halftime, a couple of the football players would grab their instrument and march at halftime. So they'd be on the field playing football and then out marching and with the marching band at halftime, boom, on goes the helmet and they're out for the next play. I'm like, wow, this is great. Like you can get involved in whatever you want to get involved with here. And then the university has that same aura about it. It's, you know, many of the faculty and administrative people live in Big Rapids. So it's just a tight knit group, and it feels like home. You feel like part of a family here. And I think over the summer, Trent, you and I, brushed on the fact that my late wife was diagnosed with cancer. It was 2015 in the fall. And that's when I knew I had made the right choice to stay here, and that the community was so supportive, and so is the university during her her battle with that. And I don't know that you could get something like that at other places. It's a tight-knit community, and when something like, you know, difficulties arise, people step up and are very supportive.
Well, that's very well put, Coach. And I think that as much as Big Rapids means to you, I think they would say the same for you and what you've meant to them. We do want to close out with something that we call one hitters. And so these are questions that are a little bit more lighthearted and, just to kind of pick your brain and learn a little bit about, you know, your perspective. And the first thing I want to ask is these plethora of players, and we've brought many of them up, but I want to identify just a few former players. And I want you to just sort of describe what kind of player they were. Okay. We'll start a little early on here. You mentioned a guy named John Gruden. He was an All-American. What kind of player was he?
Talented. I believe he's still whole. I know it's one word answers, but
no, you're good.
Okay. John, I believe, still holds the record for most goals in the game by a defenseman. I remember he scored four against Notre Dame at Notre Dame. I think we tied 6-6 that night. but he, what a talent. He skated like a deer. And he also, it was the first time I think I realized that if you're going to make it to the NHL, it's almost like you have a genetically superior body. Like, yep. I remember watching him as a young kid go into the weight room and then do like one set of bench and get up, and I swear he put on 10 pounds. Like, his body just absorbed it. And he was genetically different than, you know, the rest of us, you know, normal citizens, if you will.
Right. All right, how about Andy Roach?
Andy Roach, great skater too, was a forward most of his career before he came here, got moved to defense. I think at forward, he was a good forward, but no one was recruiting him. Mark Kaufman went and caught him in Waterloo. One of the first games, I believe, he got moved back to defense. He's one of those kids when the game was in front of him, and with his skating ability, his offensive abilities really shined. And they didn't so much as a forward, but when he had the whole game in front of him and with his skating ability. But I just remember one of the, you know, all-time best skaters I've ever coached.
How about kind of moving along in an era here, Rob Collins?
Oh, Robbie Collins, another very talented player. Not overly big, made it to the National Hockey League, but very tenacious, very competitive, and very driven. Yeah, he was, I'm remiss if I had mentioned him earlier as well.
Yeah. And obviously the poster boy, we got to ask about Chris Kunitz.
Highly competitive. Probably the most competitive individual I've coached. Quick story on Chris. He was in Pittsburgh. He just signed a new contract, a really, very lucrative contract. And he came back for the alumni golf outing. We played a charity softball game on the Friday before the alumni outing on that Saturday. So our past players play the first responders in Big Rapids charity softball game. Chris is in the outfield, and it's like 21-21 is tie scored in the seventh. some typical softball game.
Yep.
Guy hits a fly ball, and I watch Chris tracking this ball and running, and he full out, lays out, dives, and makes the catch. And I'm like, if the GM in Pittsburgh saw this, he would have. I'm like, but it's just who he is. He was just, it didn't matter what you're doing or what you're playing. He was playing for keeps. And in this softball game, when no one would have begrudged him just half-heartedly jogging for the ball, he did that. And I'm like, well, that's what makes Chris Kunitz Chris Kunitz.
That's awesome. One more for you, Chad Billens.
Chad Billens, very heady player. talented, could skate, but extremely heady, really good vision on the ice, consummate teammate, great captain.
Awesome.
And very intelligent to boot.
I'm kind of a flip here. Who is the toughest player you've ever had to game plan for?
Oh, against? Well, I remember Anson Carter early in my career.
I like this story.
Yeah, playing for Michigan State. And the one guy I referenced earlier, Dwight Parrish, was a walk-on defenseman for us. His dad was foreman on the line at, I believe it was Ford Motor Company. And this kid was tough as nails. And so when we're playing Michigan State at Joe Louis, we ended up matching up Dwight Parrish against Anson Carter. Now, Dwight, he played professionally in like Ireland. And so that's the kind, but him and Anson, it was a 60-minute war out there. And Dwight, maybe the toughest player I ever coached. One of the other guys we haven't mentioned who was a very good player, signed after 2 years, Dave Karpa. He was another tough character. But it was one of the all-time great battles between Anson Carter and Dwight Parrish. And I don't know if Anson Carter even knows who Dwight Parrish is today.
Right, right.
I think he knew who he was. I know that.
On the flip, who's, can you identify maybe the most talented player you've ever had the privilege of coaching?
Wow. Yeah, it would have to be Chris Kuditz, overall most talented player. And he could do it all. He could score. He was very physical. He wasn't overly big, maybe 5'10", 5'11". He could fight. We had a couple games. We had a bench clearer against Michigan, and Chris more than handled himself in that. So he could play the game a lot of different ways. I think that's why he found himself on, Sidney Crosby's flank, because he could. One other thing I asked him once, I said, Chris, you could score more goals. Like you could, if you shot more, and this is, when he's playing for Pittsburgh, I said, I think you could score. He goes, yeah, I could probably score more. And I would find myself not in Sidney Crosby's line anymore. He goes, but my job is to get the puck. Get in on the forecheck, get the puck, and get it to Sid. And, I'll score my goals when I can. But, you got to understand the reason you're here. And I thought that was a pretty good answer.
I got to ask you, because we bring some players on the show, and we ask them, where's the toughest place you guys have played, or maybe the toughest place you played in college hockey. And for you, in 32 years, do you have a building that's just the loudest every time, or a building that sticks out as the loudest building you've ever coached in?
Well, one of the best experiences with that was at Cornell. I thought their fans are terrific there. We beat them the second night. We split there, and we beat them the second night. It was a big win for us, and we're going through the handshake line, and the students are chanting at a safety school. And the great thing is none of us knew what that meant. They were like, it's an Eastern thing. I guess it's a school right. You would apply to is a safety school that you can get in. So they're chanting it. But the thing is, it went right over all our heads. You guys are a little too sophisticated for us. But it was their band was right over our locker room. And the drum starts before warm-ups. And, it's just a pretty cool environment.
And, this is, again, it's kind of a loaded question. So apologies in advance. But 3 decades is a lot of time to start accruing stories and some favorite coaching stories. But is there one story that sticks out that'll always kind of tickle you that you can look back on and laugh at?
Well, there's one over the years, and we haven't done this. Now people are more sophisticated. But back in the day when I started, what we would do on our trips, like our first trip into the Upper Peninsula. And for those that don't know, you go over what's called the Mackinac Bridge. And a lot of times to start the year, we would play maybe non-conference and play like a Cornell or a St. Lawrence. And we would cut through Ontario to get to the, it shortens the time drastically.
Right.
So you go through the border. Well, then when our first trip to the Upper Peninsula, and you go over this big body of water, the Mackinac Straits, on the Mackinac Bridge, we would tell the players to get their visas ready as we approach the bridge. And invariably there'd be a freshman saying, I didn't know we were going into, you know, into Canada. And so then we would tell him, oh yeah, it was on the board. You didn't see it. So we go hide in the bathroom. And so they would go in the bathroom and we'd put blankets and pillows on them. And then we drive over the bridge. And if you've been there enough, there's a government looking building at the end of the bridge. And we would pull over and we'd get the kid out of the bathroom and said, hey, you got to go in. You got to go talk to these people. And we'd go into the building. And it was pretty funny because they were used to us doing it. The guy would say, hey, wrong bridge, kid. And he'd come back on and we'd all get a pretty good laugh out of it. But, you know, as time went on more, you know, these kids get around more and you couldn't have that kind of fun. But that was always a good time for everybody.
Oh, man, that's great, Coach. Well, Coach, we appreciate you coming on and talking with us. It's always a pleasure to chat with you, Coach Daniels. And, we love to hear the stories and we love to just, to hear what hockey was like even in the 90s and 2000s, just because, you know, that's when we were growing up. I mean, I think you took over this program, and I don't want to make you feel old or anything, but you took over this program when I was 3 years old. I don't think Jerry was born.
Yeah, I'm only 28, Coach. I
you weren't even born. You know, Trent, and I bet at 3 years old, you were saying to yourself, what's he doing with that power play?
Oh, man. Well, Coach, you know, again, thanks for coming on and thanks for chatting with us. And it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a blast. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. All right. Once again, thank you to Bob Daniels for joining the show. Subscribe to the CCHA show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. And subscribe to the CCHA on YouTube. Follow us on Twitter at Trent Singer, at Jared Urbato BP. You can check out our work at BemidjiPioneer.com and SiouxFallsLive.com.